I am an alcoholic.
I claim it.
That is a touching introduction, isn't it? It just get you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kind of hard to follow an introduction like that. You expect so much. I'm glad to be here. I really am. I was born in Denver, and I get over here but rarely to this part of the country, and it's a beautiful part of the country, and I'm delighted that your committee included me in the program this year. I want to thank Tim and Dan for coming to the airport and picking me up. Are they here? They were real anxious to hear me talk. Kind of a thirst for the AA program and the message. Getting ready, possibly, for the ice cream social. It's interesting getting around a little bit. I had you always wonder if the person that's supposed to meet you at the airport will hook up with you. We seem to recognize one another in some weird way. A few months ago, I was out of my office. I got on the phone and I called my office for messages, and the receptionist said, "Well, you sure lead an interesting life." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, I didn't know you were going to be in Cincinnati this weekend." And I said, "Yeah, I am. How do you know?" And she said, "Well, there's a message here from a guy named Bob that he says that he's going to meet you at the airport, and you'll know who he is because he's going to he has a wooden leg and he'll be holding a big book." And by God, he had a wooden leg and a big book. Turned out he was a Hell's Angel that had been lost that leg in a motorcycle accident. Heady looking guy, I'll tell you. He'd had a lot of tattoos and a lot of hair and stuff. He'd been sober a couple of years, but there was still a lot of street in him where people that ordinarily wouldn't mix, and it was kind of like that with me and Bob that weekend. We went down to the parking lot and got into his Pinto. I was glad he was driving a Pinto. And you know, the funny thing about it is, by the time he took me back to the airport on Sunday morning, he and I were fast friends. I hear from him every once in a while, and he is a dear, dear man. And we laughed and we cried and we carried on that weekend, and we had ourselves quite a good. In fact, he had a gift for me that he gave me at the airport as I was leaving. He dropped me off and he got out of the car and he came around and gave me a big hug and he said, "I got a gift for you," and it was in a brown bag, and I opened it up and it was his first wooden foot that you go. A lot of things go through your mind, you know, when you're I didn't really want to go through all those detection systems with a wooden foot in my. But it's what he had to give. I let him keep it. He keeps it for me there in Cincinnati. I'm glad to be sober. Let me ask you a quick question just for drill. How many people are here in their first early days, say your first 60 days of Alcoholics Anonymous? Are the people in that? There's a hand over here, a couple of hands. Welcome. Nice to have you here. Welcome. I really welcome you here. I just think it is so delightful that you have had an opportunity to come to a conference like this and in your sobriety. There is a great celebration here, as you have already discovered this weekend. A great celebration. And you're going to hear some absolutely wonderful, wonderful speakers. I loved what Fran had to say, and I know that I know personally the two people that are going to speak tomorrow night, and Vinoy and Frank, and they are wonderful, and I'm looking forward to hearing the other speakers at the conference, and it's really my privilege to be here with you. And if you are new and beginning your journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have cut your problems in half just by coming here to AA, even though you're beginning. And you may think that your problems are deep and diverse and without solution. There are real answers here, and that is true. And the extraordinary discovery is you will discover that what really is here are questions, and you have the answers. You have your answers. And when you begin to get that idea, you will find that this is a very empowering program. And I didn't know that when I got here. I got here because a bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. In those days, they didn't have any hospital programs. It was unheard of to think that insurance would pay for... I got sober in Glendale, California, a little suburb out of Los Angeles, and I had been to a few institutions, but none of them were constant. Well, there was one place out in the valley, they called, run by a guy named Ron Shire. They called it Shire's Dryer, and he had kind of a spin dry operation out there, and he was I lived, in those days, I lived in a garage with four other guys, and a double garage. I want to establish that we weren't crowded. And I sold encyclopedias door to door, and I went to jail, and I went to county hospital, and I slept occasionally in the park, and it seemed like Skid Row was not that far away. There were warrants out for my arrest, and life was not good. Life was bad, and out of all of that mess, a guy that had befriended me and had bailed me out of jail and had given me a job selling encyclopedias brought me to you. Without really knowing who you were, without really knowing what might happen to me here, he pulled me out of that garage and brought me here to you. And nothing in my life has been the same since he did that. And it's interesting because I think he's surprised as I am at the difference. I say that because every year on my birthday I call him and thank him for bringing me here. And when I say, "Don, it's Clint Hodges," there's usually a little... pause. He says, "Yeah, Clint, where are you?" And I tell him, and I thank him, and I tell him I'm sober, and that AA is alive and well, and it's the last August, last month, I called him on my birthday. My birthday is on the 14th of August, and it was the 24th time that I had called that man. And I was telling him that I was sober 24 years in my head. And that, I can assure you, is something that brings the phrase God's grace to mind. And it has been some kind of a journey for 24 years. I was 29 when I got here. I'm 53 now, and these 24 years, almost half my life, have been here with you. And I love it here. I love my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love what these steps will do for us. There is a notion that Alcoholics Anonymous works slowly, that this program works slowly, and it, possibly it does. I don't think so, but it might. It's sort of like this. On the 14th of August, 1966, I was a drunk. And on the 15th of August, 1966, I was not a drunk, and I have not been a drunk since. And that strikes me as being rather brisk movement. I mean, as there is a wonderful efficiency to the energy here, to the power that's here, to the love that's here. And you will move. I had no idea, of course, that I would ever come to a place like Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised in a home where these ideas, these spiritual ideas that are expressed in AA, were expressed there. I was raised in a home where drinking was also expressed there. My dad drank a lot. My mother took us to church a lot. And the conflict that was built in was just a joy to behold, I'll tell you that. And it was kind of funny because, the church made me nervous. We went to the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, and sitting there in the pew on Sunday morning while the minister, a very fundamentalist and very energetic kind of a guy, would get really going and talk about hellfire and brimstone and talk about eternity and talk about burning forever. And if it had just been 10,000 years or something, but forever. And I'd see people go down to the front of that little church and get saved. And I wanted to do that sometimes, because it seemed like their life was easy. Then they were committed to something. They believed in something. They had a center. There was an energy to them. But on the other hand, sometimes I would see them and they'd given their heart to Jesus and they didn't look like they were real happy about what they'd done with their heart. It kind of made them grumpy and a little bit ill at ease. And so I stayed on that back pew. My uncle went down there and got saved. They sent him to China to be a missionary. And I thought, My mother used to ask me, my dad had an interesting question too, come to think. He used to say, when are you going to be a man? I don't know. And my mom's questions were even more disconcerting. Where will you spend eternity? Have you found God yet? She'd say, no, I didn't want to find God. I knew by then he was a little annoyed with me. And she liked to say, what will you do when you meet your maker? I don't know. Apologize, maybe? I don't know what the hell I do. What will you... She wanted me to be an evangelist. She wanted me to go to Prairie Bible Institute in Western Canada and to be an evangelist. And I was already mad at her, and there was no way I was going to ever do anything that would make her happy. And I didn't want to do that. I had no idea, as I do today, that work is a little more varied than I had thought in those early years. So I may have a gift for it after all. I don't... My relationship with alcohol started when I was in high school. My mother had died, and my dad had remarried a time or two, had brought a series of sparring partners into the home. Boy. Things got pretty colorful around there for a while, and I got mad at my dad, too. You know, it's... there's something that happens to us, a lot of us, along the way. We get angry with those people that mean so much to us. And we begin to shove the caring down. We begin to see the caring as dangerous and painful. I care and I have dreams and I get disappointed. And my answer to that is, pass on the dreams, shove the caring down. It's not worth it. And you get an attitude, it kind of hardens into a personality, and you can just see the kids with, in Los Angeles anyway, where I live, their punked up hair and safety pins in their cheeks, and you know, they want to make sure you know they don't care. They get strange, they get weird. There's a sign in a little shop on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles that says, guess your sex, 25 cents. It's a, and I would have been, I suppose, in today's culture, a runaway. And I wasn't then. We wound up going to high school in North Africa at a little base out there in, near Casablanca. And I was at a football game and then a party afterwards, and we had, somebody had vodka and orange juice, and they gave me a drink of vodka and orange juice. And I'll tell you something, that night I knew. I was 16 years old, and it was at a party, and it was vodka and orange juice. And I knew. I mean, I remember my first drink with real remembrance. If you're new here tonight and you remember your first drink, welcome home. I don't remember my first taco, but I remember... it meant something. God, there was a sweetness to that. You shove that caring down, and you shove the dreams down, and you shove the love down, and you're not living real well. That is not a rich life. That is a life where you have to put discipline into it on a moment-by-moment basis to make sure they never get that you care. And after a while, you almost don't. You forget how, and you forget the dreams, and you start living out your second choices and your third choices. And that booze makes that possible to do without the constant discipline on it. That's what's so sweet about what that booze did to me. It started at a party when I was 16 years old, and when the party was over, I was 29 and living in that garage in Glendale. And in that intervening time, I did some stuff. I had been given more than I ever knew by my parents. I had been given the idea by my dad of a work ethic, of patriotism, of decency, of keeping agreements. My mother gave me love, and I didn't think so. She gave me an awareness of God's grace, and I didn't think so. They both gave me a lot. And it's been important for me to look at that and to get appreciative of what they gave me. I've been working with a guy in Los Angeles whose mother treated him badly from his point of view, and whose father abandoned him. And he grew up with the notion that his father was a flake and his mother was a cruel, real stinker. His notion was, his father's a flake, his mother's a bitch. And that he wasn't raised well. And as I have worked with this guy, I've realized that I had those notions. And you know, if you really feel that you weren't raised well, somehow or other, we have to let the world know that. It's odd, isn't it? We're kind of walking around as the advertisement of how bad our folks did raising us. And it's important to me. It becomes my excuse. I've got to let them know. And I let them know by the very fabric of my life. I mean, I can't hold a job. You might think my folks did a good job. I got to drive a 20-year-old car. If I drove a new car, you'd think my mom loved me. You know, it's kind of weird that we put out our message to the universe by the fabric of our lives, and this kid's been doing that. He's been around AA for 20 years, and he's now 35, and he's got 4 years now. And last week when he went up to tell his mother that he loved her, he was free of that. He finally began to look at it from her point of view, through inventories, and through appreciation, and through forgiveness. And he's moving for the first time. And I've been through that. And we all must. You know, in a book that's not conference approved, it says, honor thy father and thy mother. And it doesn't say, honor them if they're doing it your way. You know, it just... And it doesn't say, so you'll be a good boy. It says, so your days will be long on the earth. It isn't about being good. It's about a good life. Well, I didn't know any of that. I just knew I had an attitude. And that attitude, I got out of the house as soon as I could. I went back to college in Oregon. I got to dental school. I spent 2 years out of a 4-year program at the University of Oregon Dental School. I got a problem because by this time I've added dexedrine to my diet. And there's this mild requirement for manual dexterity in dental school. And when you start out the day by dropping 15 milligram spanchels of dexedrine into a cup of coffee because you're hungover, that sets you up on a high tremor. And it gives you a great sense of accomplishment. If I could have talked, I would have been glad to have told you about it. But we'd be in that clinic on Saturday morning from 8 to 12. I'm supposed to be doing something for a patient. And that got pretty colorful. They just come out with those new high-speed air-driven hand pieces, and you could wipe out a quadrant of teeth just twitching with those babies. A guy came up the second year. I'd put a set of dentures in his mouth the first year, and he brought his wife up the second year, and somebody was working on her. And he'd see, I hated to see him, Jack, coming up there. God, every time he'd see me across the clinic, he'd go, say, Clint. Say. They finally threw me out of there. My friend Angie says it best, but if any of you got any dental work done in 1959 at the University of Oregon Dental School, well, I'd like to make my amends tonight. I moved to Skid Row is what I did. You can't drink up on the hill in those bars by the dental and medical school. You run into somebody that knows you got thrown out. Drinking on Skid Row is easy drinking. They don't, you know, the difference I finally realized, one of the main differences is that they never ask awkward questions on Skid Row. Like, how are you? And my life became interesting. I went to jail for the first time, Christmas Eve 1959 in Portland. I blacked out and began to do it. I came out of a blackout in a little Skid Row cafe that was lit brighter than this room with neon tubes. I was sitting at a wooden table. I was sitting across the table from an Indian lady, it looked like to me. I don't know where we'd met. I was some delicate flower that I had invited to dine that night. She had chili all over her face. God knows what our relationship might have been. We could have been together for days. I have no idea. It scared me, though. I had that little bit of awareness, and I felt very like I was going to go to jail. I was subject to arrest. And I got up, lurched over, and paid that little tab, the bill, and I was so disgusted that. And I walked back to the men's room, and it was one of these places that still had a little sliver of mirror on the wall in the men's room. And I looked in that mirror, and I had chili all over my face. Just a match set, boy, slowly pitching forward into bowls of chili. When I got here, you asked me if I was powerless over alcohol. It's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, powerless and alcohol come into my life at about the same time. You didn't ask me if I was alcoholic. I would have said no. I know what an alcoholic is. Alcoholic's the guy in the next cell. He's the guy at the end of the bar. An alcoholic, I'll tell you something, an alcoholic doesn't have a car. I got a car. Someplace I've got a car. Alcoholic sleeps on the park in the park. I got a garage. I did some weird stuff. You ever get a half a haircut? That's an problem. The barber says, "What do you mean you gotta go?" You say, "I gotta go. I gotta go. I'll be done in a minute. I gotta go. I'll come back tomorrow. Is that all right?" You walk out of there a little lopsided. Powerless, total strangers come up to you and deprive you of your physical freedom. Isn't that an interesting thing? People you have never met before say things like, "You're under arrest." "Who are you?" I always wanted their badge number. I want a jury trial. Last time I got arrested for drunk driving was in Glendale that spring. I'm driving down the street. I've been drinking in a beer bar since 6. It's now about 10. They were giving me near beer. I'm sure it was near beer. It wasn't doing the job. And I'm on my way to get a real drink. And the light was red. I stopped. The light turned green and amber and red, green, amber. I was resting. And the guy right behind me was in a squad car, Glendale PD. So pretty soon he's up rapping at the window. They get so cute. Yeah. You know what annoyed me? He didn't even put on his hat. I remember that. But he did say, "That's the only shade of green we have here in California." Yeah. And pretty soon he gets me out of the car and he has me touching my nose and doing all of that stuff. And then it's rest and put your hands behind your back and get in the car and all of that stuff that begins to change you from being a citizen to being a prisoner. The process in which you are totally powerless. I mean, you are going to get in that car. You may not do it right away, but you will get in there. It just depends on how many little raps on the head you want to take. You get in the cell, they say, just relax, I'll move your hand. You know, you can't even get the feel of the fingerprinting process. I was so angry. Police state. And then about 3 weeks later, somebody showed me the police report he had written down. He said, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. Whatever that meant. And I want a jury trial, right? Pretense and image and being cool are important in that whole thing. And I wanted to be cool. I heard a woman in AA say, you can't get well in style. I thought, oh boy, that's bad news. I want to be cool. I'll tell you how cool I was. In that little room that I had, the garage was cut up into four rooms, and I've got a little room, an $11 a week, 8x10 room that male alcoholics occupy in Glendale, California. I don't know what you live in Colorado Springs, but in Glendale, they're just little smelly 8x10 rooms with a electric light coming out of the ceiling on a cord, a bulb, a pull cord. It smells in there. There's nothing on the wall. Food, maybe, but no. There's a sink, toilet someplace. You don't need the toilet. You got the sink. Really an elegance to that kind of a lifestyle, I'll tell you. The linoleum floor is sticky. You can hear yourself walking across it. And there is a group of people that tend to gather at the door late at night to discuss your case, and you can barely hear them out there. And you get your courage all up and you go grab that door open and they're gone. They've disappeared. Things drift out of your line of vision and you wonder what they were. And there's a radio that plays and plays and plays and plays. You cannot turn it off. Even when you unplug it, it continues to play. And one night I woke up about 4, I guess, or 3 in the morning. It was dark in there. It was not so dark that I didn't see the rat over in the corner. And I was under the bed. And I don't know how long I'd been there, and I don't know how long that rat had been looking at me, but that rat scared me bad. He was a big one, and he and I both knew that he would win. I was thinking about getting up on the bed, and I'd get up on an elbow, and I'd black out or pass out, and I'd come to, and that rat would be there, and that rat scared me to death. I knew he'd take my eye out when he charged me. We have such a rich imagination in those days. You know, afraid to step into the street from the curb because you'll get dragged a block by a truck. Afraid to take a shower, you'll fall through the glass door. And I knew that rat would get me. And it feels like hour after hour after hour. The 4 a.m.s of our lives. And I came to again, and that little more light had come into the room, the first light of day, and I looked again, and in some strange way, that rat over in the corner had turned into a pair of socks. And that's how cool I was. I was held hostage by a pair of socks all night. And that's called alcoholism, is what that is. If you're new here tonight and you think this is a dramatic disease, no. It's just made up of the nickels and dimes of our lives. It's just those compromises that go on. It's what we trade away for our right to chemical peace of mind. And we give up bits of our soul, and we give up our self-respect, and we give up our capacity to look in a mirror, because we don't want to know. We long ago don't want to know what we're going to see there. And it is impossible to get to sleep at night, because our minds are so loud, unless we're just gone. Our minds get so busy, and we can't get drunk enough finally not to know that we're in big trouble. And so we drink for oblivion. And if we go to bed less than stoned, we stare at the ceiling, and our minds just go and go. Chuck C., a guy that used to have a huge impact on me in Southern California, died sober a few years ago now. He said he had what he called a grand central head when he came to AA. Just so busy, so endlessly busy and loud. And the conscious part of our mind, it just drives us crazy. And it tells us that it's in charge. And we think that's who we are. It may be 6% of our mind, and we think that it's us. It tells us that it's us. It is not a good taskmaster. Good servant, bad taskmaster. But we listen to it, and we try to drown it, and we try to do something with all of those awful, awful thoughts. Because my life is a series of nickel and dime compromises that just make me crazy. Make me absolutely crazy. I was out one night. There was one I could not extinguish. There were many I couldn't extinguish, but one of them in particular was such a bothersome thing to me. I was out on the prowl one night. I was in the Marine Corps. I was on active duty. I'd gone through officer candidate school because the sign outside of the post office in Portland said, "The Marine Corps builds men." And I thought, I hope so. Wouldn't that be nice? And so I went through officer candidate school, and I got commissioned, and I'm down at Camp Pendleton, and then up at El Toro, and I loved the Marine Corps. They invited me to resign my commission for the good of the service and to avoid trial by courts martial, and it broke my heart. Because I didn't know I couldn't drink. And I'm living at home with my wife and my little boy, and one night I'm out on a looking for her. Oh, I wanted so much to find her. And I didn't look for her in the library. My friend Cliff R. from Oceanside said he never did come out of the blackout to discover he'd spent the weekend helping the poor. And I didn't either. I didn't operate like that. I was out there in those bars. And one night at a party, I found her. Oh, there's a joy to that. Brings tears to your eyes. There she was. We've got this wonderful communication going. I'm drifting in and out of a blackout, and we're doing so well. God, I'm so glad I found her. Warm and beautiful and loving and understanding. And out of nowhere, she said, "How come you're drinking so much?" Well, I knew she wasn't the right one after all. I recognized her for the cold bitch she really was. And I don't know how to respond to that. So I come up with a lie. And the lie drove me crazy, and it'll never be on a police blotter. I never did a nanosecond of jail time for this lie. But up here, it never let me alone. I said, "I'm drinking a lot because my wife and little boy were killed not long ago in a car wreck." And I'll tell you something, you can't drink enough not to know you denied the existence of your own family to impress some lady in a party that you never see again. And those kinds of things are just there. as part of the fabric of a life that I'm very sick of. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous because that bail bondsman brings me to you. And I think you're nice people. And it strikes me that you, it's clear that you used to drink. It's clear that you finally gave up your right to chemical peace of mind. I got that. And it's clear that something has made a difference in your life. And you read these steps and you do all that stuff and there's nothing new there. And I can conclude only that whatever it is that has worked for you has not worked, would not work for me, because none of these are strange ideas. There's all a familiarity to it. A higher power, amends, an inventory. Shortcomings. We use those ideas, call them different names sometimes, but not new stuff. And what am I going to do? My big problem is I got a really loud mind and I don't sleep well. I cannot get to sleep at night if I don't drink. How do you do that? And I asked a guy that one night and he gave me an answer. An interesting answer. He said, I'll tell you what, you really want to sleep tonight? I said, yeah. He said, where do you live? I didn't tell him I live in the garage, but I said, I live alone. He said, well, just for openers, why don't you make your bed? And I thought, oh, God. Housekeeping hints from me. Jeez. He looked at me and he saw that dull gray film come down over my eyes. He said, really? Put clean sheets on your bed. And I wondered how he knew about those sheets. The chaplain never mentioned the sheets. They know more here than they're supposed to know. And he said, when you get into the bed tonight after you make your bed, say a little prayer to yourself. He even told me the prayer, if God be for us, who can be against us? Well, that's St. Paul. I knew that was St. Paul. I never did like St. Paul. But when I got back to the garage, to my little room that night, I was thinking about that guy and what he had said to me. And there was one thing I couldn't get out of my mind. He knew about those sheets. And so I found some clean sheets from someplace and I put them on that cot. I got into the cot and I started to, I'm not going to say that stupid prayer. Too cool. But he knew about the sheets. So I said the stupid prayer. I knew it wouldn't work. And I slept all night. I hadn't slept like that in a year. Just slept. Slept. There's something wonderfully healing about a night's sleep when you're new. I loved those meetings at the beginning. I discovered something important. I discovered that I felt better at 10 o'clock than I did at 8:30 if I went to a meeting. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, I would go to a meeting when I was new. I'd say to myself, I'm going to stop and get a drink on the way home. And I would be back home at midnight in my bed, and it would occur to me, I was going to get a drink tonight. Oh, well. Oh, well. What happened to rob a service center? You know, what? Well, I write bad checks. I steal. I do whatever. It occurs to me to drink, I drink. And I am now at, oh, well. What happens around here? How can a meeting make that much difference? It's not the coffee, I can tell you that for sure. In those days we had jelly donuts, we had porcelain cups. Those things don't seem to have the magic in them. I'll tell you what it seems like to me after 24 years and looking back on the journey and looking back on the joy of it. It seems to me that when we come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, We have an opportunity to do something that we don't do and haven't done very much in our lives. We get into the room with one another. See, I think I can either be here in the room with you, or I can be up here in my head, worrying about tomorrow and terribly remorseful over yesterday. And if I'm up here in my head, where it is so loud and so busy, and where the sun never shines, I'm not doing so good. And I come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with more problems than I can possibly imagine, not really believing that they have been cut in half, not knowing how it's all going to turn out. And somehow or other, I calm down here. I see somebody get a 30-day chip, or I hear a speaker that moves me, or somebody says, one guy in a meeting one night said he'd taken his radio out to the laundry tubs to drown it. Boy, he got me in the room, I'll tell you that. Man, really, you had one of those radios? I sat in a meeting on a Sunday night in Wilshire, Normandy in Los Angeles, early in my sobriety, and a lady at the podium got me in the room. She just had me. I liked this lady anyway. Her name was Gail. She's died sober since then. She was a classy lady, and I liked something else about her. I was never very close to her. She was quite pretty, striking, really, and I liked her a lot. And the reason that I liked her when I was new is because she looked real cynical. And I figure if she was going for this thing, maybe there was something to it. So I kind of watched her, you know. And one night she's at the podium. Gail's talking about the alcoholic's prayer. And the story she tells to illustrate the point is a story where she came out of a blackout in her apartment in Hollywood, and she was sitting on the mantel over the fireplace with her cat. And they had a little vodka and cat food up there, something for everybody. And as the story unfolded, it turned out that she was up there because there was 8 inches of water on the floor. And that was because she'd started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal had gotten away from her somehow. You know, just... I mean, my kind of girl, right? She's a pig and I like that. So I go get him, Gail. Oh, I loved it. And she said the alcoholic's prayer goes like this: my God Almighty, what's wrong with me? And I said that prayer. Oh, I've said that prayer. What is wrong with me? But that woman that night in that meeting got me into the room. And you do it to me. You get me there. I got two places that I can be. I can be up here. My sponsor says, are you going to go home and catch up on your worrying, are you? Or I can be in the room with you. I mean, and this is reality. It's like the chairs and the carpet and the people and it's reality. Up here is not. My mind tells me it is, but it is not. That is not reality. That is just electrochemical crap it's remembrances, you know, it's guilt, it's all kinds of stuff. But it doesn't have much to do with what's going on here. And this is what's going on right here. This is the journey. I laughed one night. A guy told a story there where we live. His name is Jack. He was at a party at a house in Los Angeles, a big home. It was an AA birthday party. There were 100 people in the home, and he's in the kitchen talking to a guy, and the guy says, you know, there is a lady from Honduras out in the living room, and I think you would really like this lady a lot. He said, no kidding. And they said, where is she? And they look through the people, and she's out there in the red dress on the couch. And Jack said, oh, she's pretty. He said, would you like to meet her? And he says, yeah. And they're walking from the kitchen through the dining room out into the living room to go meet the lady from Honduras. And Jack's thought was, God damn, I don't want to live in Honduras. You know, just boom. I mean, it just illustrates the point. And the, you know, if you're new here, the people that are the most joyous, the freest, are here in the room. They're doing whatever they're doing 100%. It's an interesting way to live. I always save a little something, you know. I don't know why. I think I have to supervise my problems. I love having, I'm the guy with the problem. I love being in a discussion meeting. I say, here's my problem. Oh, I love that problem. It's where my problems are. I get my problem out here and I look at it and I examine it and I get everybody else interested in my problem. This is it. Take some snapshots of that baby. You know. Somebody says, hey, I got a solution. Not yet. Not yet. Problem. That's all that's up here. One night I said to Chuck Chamberlain, he was in his 70s, mid-70s, and he's driving, I was living in Orange County at the time, he's driving up to L.A. all the time to go talk in a meeting. People asked him all the time, and he always said yes. And he and I are at a stag one night, and I said, Chuck, it's too much. You're going up there too much. He said, what do you mean? I said, all that traffic, you shouldn't do it. He said, what do you mean? I said, just the traffic alone. How do you manage the traffic on those freeways up into Los Angeles? And he said, I just drive the one car. I drive every car I can see, you know. One night I was driving and we were out in the desert. I said, we were early, plenty of time to get to the meeting. He was going to talk. I said, let's take this road. We can save 15 minutes. He said, what are you going to do with it? Put it at the end, I guess. I don't know what that. But he was always kind of right there, you know, wherever he was. He was doing it. And the meetings will get us in the room with one another. So if you're new, go to lots of meetings. You'll be told, go to lots of meetings. And you'll feel better after the meeting. Unless your purpose is to be bored or upset. And then you can have that too. But if you get in the room, you'll find yourself loving somebody, taking a chip or saying something. See, this isn't about quitting drinking. This is about learning to live in such a way that we don't have to go back to it. That's all. And it's pretty simple. It's really quite simple. We're either coming from fear or we're coming from love. And if we're coming from love, things are good. I noticed that if I'm coming from love, I don't have to be looking for it. I noticed that if I'm coming from love in whatever I'm doing, my self-worth is not an issue. And if I'm coming from fear, I wonder about myself. And I have that choice. If I'm coming from fear, I tend to do things to bolster my self-worth. I go to work more, or I go to AA, or I'll go out and do something in AA. But I do it with an attitude. I do it with a little bit of an edge. I do it to try to get my self-worth up there. And it never works. It never works. But if I'm here with you, and if I'm just, and you can make that decision, you know, I'm going to come from love. I'm going to let the fear go. And it's a whole different world. The steps will do some things for you that are astonishing. See, with the temporary, the short-term solution is a meeting where you get in the room. But it still leaves all that stuff up here. What if there was a way that you could take a paper and a pencil and write it all down? That would move it out into reality a little bit. That's called step four. The inventory is the inventory of those thoughts. It's all you can inventory. What if there was a way to read that stuff to somebody else? That's step five, and that further drains the swamp. What if you could look at all of that stuff and assess it and see how you contributed? Because we did, you know. We're the author of our problems. They are primarily of our own making. All of them. Especially the ones that we are certain were caused by somebody else. And most of us run around with some kind of a sense of impending doom. And I always thought that was so mysterious. Alan McGinnis one night said, that's just the fear that I'm going to walk out here on the street and somebody's going to come up and hit me in the mouth because I treated him badly. And I'll have it coming. What if there was a way I could make a list of those people? And be willing to make amends and to set the record straight and to talk to them and to pay the money back. That makes that sense of impending doom go away. And the freer we are up here, the more we can be in the room with one another. If there's a lot of crap going on up here, it's like having a tooth out in your jaw. You can't keep your tongue out of it. We just keep going up here. And the steps help us calm this thing down. And so we can be in the room with one another and we get freer. And the journey goes on. And there is, after all, joy and sweetness in it. And that's all we ever wanted. That's all we ever wanted was peace. And it's available here, as is anything that you want, as long as you're willing to find out how to get it for yourself. I got a chance to go to law school after I'd been sober 5 years. And I do that for a living today. I haven't sold encyclopedias in a long time. State of California wouldn't give me a license to drive a car when that bail bondsman brought me to you. And when I was 9 years sober, they gave me a license to practice law. And I love doing that. And I'm good at it. And I feel like I make a contribution. And I feel like when I'm in that courtroom, it's much better to be there answering ready for the defendant than being the defendant. I can tell you that. The other one, some months ago now, I guess 3 months ago, I was sitting at home on one of those rare evenings at home, and I turned on the TV, and they had a program called Kennedy Center Honors or Lincoln Center Honors. It was an honoring by, in Washington, D.C., of American musicians, Harry Belafonte and people like that, and they had entertainment there that was absolutely superb. And at the end of the evening, the last bit of entertainment was the Red Army Brigade Men's Chorus and Dance. 60 of them, and they were Russian Army people. Exquisitely trained, gifted, did their folk dances, and they sang their native songs, and they did their stuff. And at the end, the very end, the last thing they did, they reassembled on stage, and they began to sing a cappella. And you realized in an instant that they were singing in English. And in the next instant, you realized they were singing God Bless America. I was so touched. And I was in touch with how much I want peace, how much we long for peace. That camera panned, and Barbara Bush had a tear in her eye, and this person and that person. And we long for peace. And it's right here. It's right here. This program and this celebration and this journey is a journey of peace and joy and love. And I will close with this. I knew so long ago that when my mother said, "What will you do when you meet your maker?" "I don't know, Mom." And I suppose if she were here tonight, she's been dead many years, she might ask that same question. "What will you do?" And I used to think, I'll tell her, I'm going to tell him I got sober and I paid the money back, and I did. But you know what the real answer is? The real answer is the most extraordinary answer in the world. What will you do when you meet your maker? "Mama, Mama, we already met. We already met. Those guys in that club in Glendale introduced us 24 years ago, and I meet him every day, and he's here tonight. Thank you."